Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You are listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. And this week, we are looking ahead to what the future holds.
I think I still have a really, like, childish vision of people on hoverboards and things like that. Maybe not, like, anytime soon, but I do think like that when I think of the future.
We probably will head towards insect corn burgers for our protein.
I think we're all going to upload our brains into a shared consciousness and then just live for infinity, knowing everything.
I'd like holograms, please.
I think maybe in the future we might have some really interesting dilemmas if we ever do find life on other planets. So we have to think about, do we want to be infected by their germs? Do we want to infect us to infect them with our germs?
I think they'll just be trying to grow on every surface and create energy on every surface as well.
And Pokemon Go will be real.
Wouldn't that be amazing if Pokemon Go could be real? Well, there we go. Some interesting thoughts that we gathered this week. It's a fundamentally human thing to try and predict the future. Whether you're dreaming of your next holiday, deciding what to have for dinner, or debating whether Trump will win the next election, we're always planning, predicting, and thinking ahead. But how much are our ideas of the future constrained by our understanding of the present? And is the future an inevitable path of technological progress, a hurtling train that we're strapped to and can't get off? Or do we have more power to shape it than we think? Will, in fact, the future take us backwards even? For example, if bacteria really do become resistant to all of our antibiotics. There's no such thing as a good or bad invention, only a good or bad way in which it can be used. And it's important to always think about how scientific advancements will impact our future, to analyse the ethics of what we're creating. Now, joining us today should hopefully be a man who does exactly that. Luke Robert Mason is co-founder and director of Virtual Futures, a monthly kind of talk panel which interrogates and analyses what it means to be human in the 21st century. Now, as the future is incredibly unpredictable, Luke, for some unforeseen reason, is not yet here in the studio. But do not worry, we have got plenty to pack the show with. So coming up, we will have some top tips for how to really predict the future. Famous futurist predictions from the year 2100, or is it 2100? I don't even know how to say it yet. We'll be looking at the power of language to shape our understanding. And we'll be trying to answer Luke's question of what does it mean to be human in the 21st century. Now, we've posted this on our Facebook, on our Twitter, and we've been getting some opinions back from you guys already. Producer Yaz, would you like to give us a little taste of what we've been hearing?
Yes, always so varied. It can be so positive. You can hear, like, you're on the Vox Pop. Are we going to have hoverboards? Is Pokemon Go going to be real? Is that going to happen? But at the moment, a lot of people seem to be dwelling on the changing world in a not necessarily negative, but not overwhelmingly positive way. So Gareth has said that we're at a sort of turning point in our human evolution as science and medicine mean we can live longer and live more active, positive lives into later life. So that's great. However, there's such a social and economic inequality that we have to address that before we can all sort of take a step forward together. So that's what the dilemma of the moment is. I can see that. I don't know if you agree.
And some of the stuff I've been seeing definitely talks about kind of dichotomies and dilemmas. And
yeah,
keep your ideas coming in. We will be talking about it properly right at the end of the show. And hopefully Luke will be there to give us his own thoughts on that question. Now, you can tweet us at Soho Radio, or for the first time ever, we have our own Science Mixtape Twitter.
Yay.
At Science Mixtape, obviously. And I just want to introduce the girl behind that. In fact, you want to introduce yourself.
Hi, guys. My name's Iman, and I'm the face behind the Twitter.
Welcome to the team.
Thank you.
You're doing a fantastic job. So yes, you can tweet us at Science Mixtape as well. Very exciting. And I've never actually said this on air, but you can find all of our past shows on iTunes. Just search Science Mixtape. Now, as well as that question, what does it mean to be human in the 21st century? We do, of course, as always, have our brain teaser. So this week, it is, what was the president of the Stevens Institute of Technology describing when he said, everyone acquainted with the subject will recognise it as a conspicuous failure? Because he's talking about a particular thing that was invented that he predicted would be a failure. Producer Yaz came up with this one, and she will be giving you a clue later in the show. Now, nothing left but to get on with our songs. Luckily, Luke has sent me his song choices in advance. So although I don't know the reason behind it, I can tell you that his first song is Virtual Insanity by Jamiroquai. There's something in this future that we have to veto. Future made of virtual insanity. Now always seem to gather about this love we have for useless twisting of their new technology. Oh, now there is no sound, but we all live underground. Oh, now there is no sound if we all live underground. And now it's virtual insanity. Forget your virtual reality. Daryl Zanuck of 20th Century Fox once said, "Television won't be able to hold onto any market it captures after the first 6 months. People will soon get tired of staring at a plywood box every night." And that's producer Yaz with the first of our predictions about the future that didn't really come true. And that's a point about virtual futures that I should have made earlier, which I was hoping Luke would make. So when you think of the word virtual, I don't know about you, but immediately I think of sort of virtual reality. And it's true that a lot of his talks look at quite sort of technologically related things, like they've had one on electronic empathy and they've had another on the power of prosthetic limbs. Can you upgrade the brain? Or sex bots, will they be a thing? All of that kind of stuff. But his whole point is these are virtual futures, virtual in its original term of being something that isn't real. And you can never have a real future because there's always infinite possibilities. And once you reach it, then it's the present. So a future is always virtual and there's always more than one possible future. And that's why it's important to kind of look at them and critique them. So yeah, I find it fascinating, like looking at all these facts and thinking about how people saw the future, because it's true that when you look ahead, your understanding is going to be completely shaped by what you already know and believe. So a really good example of this is if you took a 19th century physicist and told him of, you know, the atomic bomb or the ability to have x-rays and look inside the body, that's something he fundamentally could not comprehend because his understanding of the world would not include radioactivity or any of those kind of nuclear things. To him, that would be magic and unreal. And when he predicted the future, that is just something that would not have been within his predictions. And I find that so interesting, that how, things in the present shape our idea of the future. And it's actually really similar with language.
Yeah.
The way that you describe something will ultimately influence the way that you see it and then think about it. And so again, this is something that Luke's really interested called, he calls it mechanomorphism. I mean, it is mechanomorphism. I just never heard of it until he told me that. And as I'm sure all of you listeners are out there saying, what is mechanomorphism? It sounds kind of cool. So it's, when you think, the other word is anthropomorphism. That's one that we're much more familiar with. And that's when you take human qualities and you ascribe them to inanimate objects. You know, you might think your chair is looking a bit sad. That's a human emotion. You're ascribing it to an inanimate chair. So mechanomorphism is like the opposite. It's taking the qualities of machines and ascribing them to us, humans, and our bodies and our ideas. A really classic example of this is, at the moment, we talk about our brains as computers. I mean, we heard in the Vox Pops at the beginning, like, I think we can upgrade our minds or upload our minds as consciousness.
Yeah, that's something that you hear a lot, especially after now we have the internet. So we sort of have a grounding, you know, like you were saying before, we can think in a way of shared knowledge. And what if there was a way to upload our minds into some sort of cloud and share all of our knowledge infinitely all the time with everybody and access it without having to memorize it?
Yeah.
So I think that was amazing.
Yeah, or like living forever as a machine, robot, as they say in Friends. Yeah. But when you think about it, we think of our brains as computers. So that's probably the most advanced technology that we understand. But back in the day, we talked about, you know, we still have this phrase in our language, you can see the cogs whirring. We thought of brains as clockwork, because when clocks and watches were invented, that was a very advanced technology. And so Luke's kind of idea is, how useful is mechanomorphism as a metaphor and as a tool to understand the human body?
Do you think it's got anything to do with knowing that our brain has electrical impulses, and as our understanding is developed, we've kind of likened that to machines? the way that machines are powered.
Absolutely, I definitely
do. So
you
find a parallel in that.
Because we think of nervous impulses as similar to electricity. Yeah.
But, and that's how they're described to you when you're learning about them.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But it just doesn't quite add up, does it? I mean, I think if a brain was like a computer, we would have created artificial intelligence properly already. So I think there's some ways in which it's just not there yet. It's just woefully inadequate to describe our brain.
We just don't have the words yet.
Yeah. I mean, can you think of any other examples where language really influences the way you see the world?
I think about this all the time because it's knowing people who grow up speaking different languages. And sometimes you, it's not like you think a different thing, but the way you get there, kind of the way you look at the world, it might just be framed in a slightly different way. And it'd be interesting to speak to people who grow up speaking two or three or four languages to see if they can think about all these things in different ways. But languages have, they have different equipment. Like in some parts of the world, in the Amazon, there's a tribe, I think, and they don't have numbers in the same sense that we do. They have one, two, and many.
Yes, I've heard of this tribe. It's the Parara tribe, I think.
Yeah, so it's their sort of system of counting, because if you live in a society where it's not really that necessary to have...
Yeah, it's not like they're into banks and money.
Yeah. So you have one, two, or many, and that works for so long, and it works for them. And then how are they going to come and speak about, you know, 7, 8, and 9, and 10,000?
There's another really interesting example from psychology I've just remembered, which is to do with colours. And there's a tribe, I think it's in Africa, but as I said, it's just come to me, so I haven't looked it up properly, which have the same word for blue and green.
Oh,
and when you then show them a colour wheel with different shades of blue and green and a couple of other colours, and you say, how many colours are on this wheel, they will count the blue and green shades as one colour.
Oh, that's incredible.
I don't think the Greeks had a word for blue.
I was just about to say
that's
this.
The one. So they described the sky as bronze or something.
Yeah, everything was in shades of bronze rather than colours distinctly. And there was, I think I read about it quite recently, of a guy who did a sort of miniature home experiment on his daughter. So he made a point of never describing the sky as blue and never telling her the sky was blue and never, you know, sort of allow, not forbidding it, but not surrounding her in an environment where the sky is blue was taught to her. And then when she got slightly older, he asked her what color she thought the sky was, and she didn't say blue. She said, oh, it's kind of gray and green and glowing and bright, but not the words blue didn't enter into it. So it's fascinating. And I think this could be wrong, this could be one of those things that you read and isn't, but I think in maybe not all of Russia, but some parts, that dark blue and light blue aren't shades of the same color but distinct colors.
Yeah
Blue is, it's always blue. That's interesting.
It's because it's the one that occurs least naturally.
I guess our eyes didn't
got a lot of green, got a lot of brown, but like blue tends to be quite artificial. So in terms of like how useful this is, there's some really interesting thoughts I found from a writer called Tom Chatfield, and you can look up his article on The Guardian, that he was talking about sort of what, like, again along this theme of what does it mean to be human in the 21st century. And he was saying, well, that's kind of what does it mean to be human in a world of technology where we're living more and more and more with machines. And, you know, they're becoming really good at making our decisions for us, you know, that you can number crunch big data and find trends that we wouldn't be able to see on our own. And, you know, we've sort of coming to the brink of potentially having artificial intelligence. We call them smart and marvel at their powers because they paint this picture of a world that we can't see, and we sort of feel like we're useless. But then he says, actually, machine efficiency is a really poor model for understanding ourselves. And actually, we need to remember that our creations, those machines, they're good because they're unburdened by what makes us human. And what makes us human is that biological pot of emotion, sensation, bias, and having our beliefs, and all those kind of mental ideas that influence the way that we see the world, which machines don't have. And so when we think of ourselves as machines, we're cutting out all of those things that actually are so important to what makes us human, and that drive to connect, and that drive to have kind of a social meaning in the world. Like, all of that is lost if you're a machine.
Yeah.
And is that something that we'll be able to find new ways to describe, or is it something that we're going to just try and make machines better at?
I don't know. I think people are scared of making machines having the emotional capacities of people. Isn't that the plot of a lot of science fiction? but indeed. Maybe it could, I guess it's the sort of, it could go one way, it could go the other way.
Or we keep it separate and we just make sure they always stay rational and
yeah,
that way they can't fully replace us.
Yeah.
So there we go. I think, yeah, back to the original point, like, it's always interesting before we start thinking of the future to work out how we think about the present and realise that that is going to influence our ideas. So on to our next song, appropriately, which is Fembot by Robin. This was my favourite of Luke's suggestions. And in the next section, we'll be looking at some actual predictions of the future. Stay tuned. Rock the nation, rock it, baby. Got some news for you. Fembots have feelings too. You split my heart in two. Now what you gonna do? My system's in mint condition. No power's up on my transistors, working fine. No bitches plug me in them flips and switches. Pull up in docking position. Pop the hatch and hit ignition. Burn out, baby, ready for demolition. In describing the home of 2001, futurist Arthur C. Clarke said, "Given a compact power source, the house of the future will have no roots tying it down. Gone will be the pipes, drains and power lines. The time may come where whole communities migrate south for the winter." Crazy. Actually, in doing research...
I love that.
Yeah. Although, I mean, with migration as topical and sensitive as it is at the moment. Imagine the whole world trying to move south.
On balloons.
When I was doing some research for this podcast, I actually came up with someone's idea that we'd have tiny nanobots that could self-assemble into anything and then disassemble at a moment's notice. And that, like, when you left your house in the morning, it would disassemble and then reassemble into a shop so that while you're at work, that space could be used more productively than just being an empty house. Mm. And then when you come home at the end of the day, it assembles back into your house with all the stuff. Like, yeah. It's really crazy. I kind of don't think that will ever happen. But as an idea of how to think about objects and space and permanence, fascinating.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah.
Anyway, on to our experiment. So obviously trying to predict the future just kind of gets you into a bit of pseudoscience. But there are actually people out there called futurists who their job is trying to predict the future. So there are a couple of ways that you do this in a proper kind of sciencey way. So one thing that's really popular at the moment is using social media to predict trends. For instance, Google, they can predict when there's going to be a flu outbreak.
Really?
Yeah, and they that's do this amazing. By looking at the search terms. So they said something like the flu has a very cyclical pattern. Every winter you get like a flu outbreak and it happens right, year on year and always at the same time. And it's a very easy pattern to measure. So what they did, they took 50 million search terms and just looked at whether there were any patterns in how commonly those words were searched for. And there was a whole group of terms that were much more commonly searched for at the same times when the flu outbreaks occurred.
Yeah.
Words like symptoms, fever,
yeah.
All kind of like ones you'd obviously think of, you know, hot,
yeah.
Vaccine. And I think a few other more unusual ones as well. I remember Britney Spears coming up.
Really?
I think that was more of like an anomalous one. And yeah, and then they said that the next time they saw a big trend in those search terms, they predicted there'd be a flu outbreak, and there was. So
yeah,
that's a good example. And then another one is, because unlike search terms, social media, we put emotions onto.
Mm.
So a lot of companies might now say they've just launched a new phone, and they will track what people are saying about that phone on social media.
Mm.
And if there's lots of sort of negative comments, maybe linked to comments about batteries, then they know that the next phone needs to have a better battery life.
Yeah.
And it's helping them to predict what the market wants. So that's just a couple of ways that big companies are now trying to predict the future. There's also a guy called Philip Tetlock, who's written a book called Super Forecasting. He took 1,000 people and made them predict things about the future over a 6-month period. And he found that on average, people were no better at predicting things than monkeys throwing darts at a board. And that's like a really famous quote that's now been bandied around.
That's comforting.
Yeah. But when he broke it down, there was a small group within his large sample that were actually very good. And he called these guys super forecasters. Mm. And they even like entered a competition of trying to predict future that like lasted for 4 years. It was really cool. Yeah. You should go check him out, Philip Tetlock. Anyway, so to break it down, he said that one really important thing is to take the outside view. This is something that Daniel Kahneman also talks about. So a good example of this is trying to predict the presidential election. A lot of people will start...
Dangerous.
Yeah.
Because we have been so wrong about polls in the very recent past.
I know. So a lot of people will start by like trying to gauge the mood on the ground, like how much favour has Hillary Clinton got versus Trump, and looking at kind of, again, like this social media and analysing the mood. And they will not do that. They will start by looking at the past. They will look in history and they will say, okay, so when there was a Democratic government in power and the economy was only growing at 2%, did the Democratic government stay in power or did it change? And they'll look at those kind of trends that are much bigger picture, and it's not about the person, it's about the party and the country and how the economy is doing in general. And only once they've established this big picture, this outside view, will they then take what's called a more inside view, which is focusing on personal experiences and personal beliefs, and then they'll kind of marry those two together.
So that's I prefer that outlook, I think, because you read polls in the news about any upcoming thing, and it's been so wrong, but particularly recently, I feel, because I think people, you know, you ask people's opinion, you look on social media, you look at the trends that people are saying on the ground. A lot of people don't say what they really think to somebody they just met on the street or someone who just called them for a poll. And a lot of people who, you know, some people are very active and vocal on social media about their opinions or just in general life about their opinions, but some people just keep them to themselves and don't want to say anything.
So so you get a self-selecting population. Yeah. You're only getting the opinions of the ones who want those opinions to be known. That's what, take the outside view, look in the past, look at the trends that are bigger than your personal beliefs. And then his other top tip is trust people who are less certain, and trust being uncertain yourself. He said, you know, media loves people with clear, easy to understand ideas, and so we're always promoting people who have got confidence in this will happen or that will happen. And those people tend to have quite a sort of strong idea of the world and a strong belief, and that biases what information they absorb. It's called confirmation bias.
I love confirmation bias. Well, I don't love it. I love reading about confirmation bias, especially in the age of the internet, where what you see on the internet, down to your Google searches, you might think that's very neutral. I've searched the term, any term, and the results I've got, they're very, you know, they're neutral. They're just what the search results are, but they're absolutely tailored to all of your previous search results and anything you've got affiliated with your Google account. It will show up different results. For example, if you read the news a lot and you search the term of a country, you'll get news from that country. If you've been looking at flights recently and you type in the name of a country, they'll show you holidays in that country. And it's the information bubble that you end up being inside. Even your friends' Facebook posts, if they're posting something that you think would be that Facebook thinks you wouldn't be interested in or you wouldn't like at all, they won't show it to you, or they'll show it to you way down the list. So you think, everyone agrees with me, the world is just like me, and I don't know who these other people are, surely they don't exist, and they do.
And that's how you get that bubble of everyone being like, whoa, no one I know voted that way. I've actually got quite a fun example of confirmation bias, which works on radio.
Oh, really?
Sort of. Yeah. So when you listen to a song, if you're not quite sure what the lyrics are and someone tells you what they think they are, then you will hear those lyrics.
Definitely. I do that all the time.
So there's a really famous example where Stairway to Heaven, if you play it backwards, is meant to have hidden messages about the devil. And I've listened to it, and I remember listening to it and being like, what? And then someone gave me some words printed out. You had to read them as you listened to it, and it was all about the devil. And suddenly I felt like I could hear it. So I found a little bit more of a modern example.
Okay.
This is Taylor Swift, Blank Space, played backwards. Okay. Any idea any words that jumped out at you?
I think I got evil.
Did you get evil?
Yeah, I think I got evil somewhere.
I've already primed you with my talk about the devil. Evil was not one of the words, but I guess because you're thinking about it.
Oh my god, yeah.
Oh my god.
Wow. Because as soon as you said it, I was like, maybe I heard evil. It too.
All right, now I'm going to read you what the words, this guy on YouTube has decided they are. And then we'll play it again. Okay. And listeners at home as well, see if you can hear any of what he thinks the lyrics should be. So, said David B. Rhodes, that was his last name. they'll be back, bless you, looking for love because it's special. And then my favourite is, yes, here we had one evening under the sea, best pineapple. So particularly the pineapple one, listen out for that at the end because it's my fave. Okay, okay, here we go. Oh, it's last name. Looking for love because it's special. When I'm evening, best pineapple. That is confirmation bias in action.
Yeah,
you are welcome. Anyway, that's got completely off topic, and we were going to do an actual experiment.
We are going to do an actual miniature experiment. Yeah, let's have a song first, then we'll go to an experiment. So
okay,
have coins ready and a big decision.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a small decision, any decision.
If you want to play along at home, you need to have a decision that you're not sure about, you're really on the fence, you just can't decide, and a coin. Okay, so the next song from Luke is Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots Part 1 by The Flaming Lips. She has to discipline her body because she knows that it's demanding to defeat the
Alex Lewitt, president of Lewitt Vacuum, said in 1955, nuclear-powered vacuum cleaners will probably be a reality in 10 years.
And, well, they aren't. I think that's all we can say about that one.
And I think we're all kind of fine with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't need a nuclear-powered vacuum cleaner. It's not like it uses loads of energy anyway.
Yeah.
Right, so, Yaz.
Okay.
What am I doing?
We're going to experiment on you a little bit. Well, you've come primed with a big decision, and I have a coin, and we're going to be taking part in actually a bigger experiment from Freakonomics, where they've been trying to figure out the way that people make decisions. So the basic idea is to just learn more about how the processes where people make decisions, especially when they're kind of undecided about a big idea. So if you're struggling with a big decision or a small decision, you have to sort of bring your question and toss a coin. So heads, I do something, tails, I don't.
And you have to put it, we have to put it into their website, don't we?
Yeah.
Like, so what my question is,
mm-hmm.
and then what my coin toss was.
And what the result was.
And then I have to actually follow it and let them know.
Yeah. Although this, when we were talking about this, this immediately reminded me of that episode of Friends, and I don't know if that's really lame, when one of the characters is pregnant and she has a coin toss about whether she's going to have the baby, and it goes up the other way, and then she's like sad, and that's when she realizes that her reaction to the coin toss is when she realizes that she was just scared and she didn't
Yeah,
so maybe a coin toss is helpful.
Although I think what they were trying to do was say, are there general rules that will help us when
absolutely
we're thinking about the future?
Yeah,
so that if you are on the fence, should uncertainty
push you one way or the other. So yeah, they're doing their own
right
experiment.
Okay, so
what's your big decision?
Okay, my big decision is actually quite a big one.
Yeah,
so those of you who don't know, I work in TV as my day job. And in TV, you have lots of kind of short-term contracts and you jump around a lot. And I have been offered a job in Bristol. And to start with, it's only 2 weeks, but there's potential for it to be a much longer contract. And I'm definitely going to do the 2 weeks, but then I need to decide if I actually want to stay for longer and move to Bristol. And that's a pretty big decision. And I, you know, there's so many pros, there's so many scary things that I don't know. And so that is my question that I'm putting to the coin. Should I move to Bristol?
Okay, do you want it to be heads you move, tails you don't?
I think you should decide that for me. I want
heads you move, tails you don't. Okay, you ready?
I'm
not very good at like tossing a coin. I'm just going to throw it. Okay. It's tails. How do you feel about that?
So tails, I don't move.
Tails, you don't.
Ooh. In a way, kind of relieved and yet also maybe slightly disappointed.
Yeah. Doing something new is exciting. I can feel that too. But the coin has spoken.
So I have to follow it now.
According to Freakonomics, you do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's do it.
Okay.
Please tweet us in if you have found that coin toss helpful for any of your own
or unhelpful
indecisions. Now, back to the future. No pun intended. So I spoke earlier about these futurists who can predict the future. And they have come up with some quite amazing predictions for the year 2100. I still don't know what to say. So here's the first one.
1. We'll live in floating cities.
This is really cool. So this,
I like the sound of that, actually.
Yeah, it's awesome. This has come out.
What's on the ground if we're in a floating city? Another city?
Water?
So the floating cities are, these are the idea of a Belgian architect and design visionary, Vincent Callebaut, in 2008. And it's because we are predicting that, you know, rising sea levels by 2070 might mean that as many as 150 million people are homeless. And he says, instead of fighting the water, why don't we just colonize the water?
Yeah.
And his designs are inspired by a lily pad. So he's unveiled these designs for a 50,000 inhabitant floating city modeled in the shape of a giant water lily, like the ones you get in the Amazon. And it would have gardens for growing food underwater, aquatic gardens, a desalination part to produce drinking water, energy generation through solar, wind and wave power, and would also be outfitted with a titanium dioxide skin capable of absorbing CO2 from the atmosphere to make a small dent in global warming.
I'm sure I've read about a tribe that live on Lake Titicaca who live on like small islands completely made of
Peru.
Reeds, and then kind of just float around. So it seems like they're already there. There's a church on one as well.
In a way, it's a great idea. We're struggling with overpopulation, but the sea is like so much more of the earth than the land is.
And hardly anyone lives there.
Exactly. And I think it sounds feasible.
Yeah.
Who knows? We've got like 90 years to do. Okay.
2. We'll ride an elevator into space.
Okay. Instant reactions?
I don't really like going in a lift normally. Would I get into space? Though. What?
I think this one, it's probably one of my favourites. It sounds the most implausible.
Yeah.
But would you believe it? Scientists have been envisioning a space elevator since 1895.
Oh.
Now, the problem is the tensile strength needed for the cable at the moment is so strong it would cause any steel structure that you build it with to snap. But
it's understandable.
Yeah, because they're envisioning it to be 62,000 miles above the Earth.
Would it go really fast, or would it go normal lift speed?
I think like
what would be worse, like if it went.
I
really
think it took
quickly,
ages, or if
got,
it went
like,
really
motion
fast.
Sick, like, or
see you there tomorrow. Yeah, I guess it has to go a bit fast, so it's actually efficient, but not so fast that you get loads of G-forces.
Yeah.
So anyway, with the advent of a super strong carbon nanotubes, these are 180 times stronger than steel. People are now thinking, or visionaries, I should call them, that we could build such an elevator.
And also way lighter as well, aren't they?
One problem is, so far, we've only made a few centimetres of these pure carbon nanotubes.
Ah, we need to make a lot more.
But the futurist Michio Kaku believes we will have it being built between 2070 and 2100.
So it's just going into space?
So that we don't have like all the mess of rockets and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's not going like all the way to the moon. Sorry, just, in my imagination it's
probably
just...
Probably get in a shuttle.
Yeah.
3. Molecular manufacturing means products will be put together molecule by molecule.
What do you think of that one?
That sounds like it would be useful in a way that I've not thought of.
It's like 3D printing taken to the next level.
Yeah.
I love 3D printing. So yeah, I'm all on board with that molecular manufacturing.
Yeah, so the idea is you'd actually have like tiny nanobots called assemblers who would guide chemical reactions and literally put together atoms to create molecules and build anything you wanted from scratch.
Oh, wow.
The people predicting this think it could radically alter the global balance of economic power, erasing the advantage that developing nations have with lower costs of manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
4. We'll be able to 3D print whole organs.
Yay, 3D printing. Yes.
And I love the sound of that.
Yeah, that's really good. Because you can sort of print anything in theory, then I guess it's just the materials that you use and how do you get it to work.
Well, scientists have already managed to print skin, vertebral discs, and transplanted both of these into animal bodies successfully.
Really? So it's well on the way.
Yeah. They think it's going to be very possible to print whole organs. The harder thing will be integrating them with the massive blood vessel network successfully. Yeah. But one person thinks if there was enough funding, enough of a kind of collaborative effort, like similar to the biological equivalent of the Manhattan Project, which for those who don't know is how they created the atomic bomb, it could be possible in 10 years to have a transplantable printed kidney.
It's just the vessels, isn't it? Because if you've got it there, you just need to sort of reattach it in and make sure the blood flow is getting to every tiny little part of it.
The scary question is, will bioprinting a whole human be the next logical step? I leave you with that one.
5. Computers will be part of us. Nanobots will integrate into our bodies and enhance us.
So this one's got a lot of traction online, and it's probably one of the most interesting and most related to virtual futures. You get tiny, intelligent nanobots that will be integrated into. So we might have ones in our blood that enhance our immune system, or ones in our brain that enhance our speed of thinking, or ones in our organs that keep them healthier. But yeah, the idea that we will all be part human and part machine.
Robots.
Yeah, in a really tangible way. Mm. So there we go, future predictions.
Those are really good future predictions. I've not actually heard about them before.
Yeah, well, only time will tell. Who knows if we'll all be alive by 2100. But appropriately, our next song is Alternative Reality. So we can all think about that as we listen to this.
Excellent. The boom, boom, bang. A clunking crowd starts a rattle and shake. Lights are flashing, faces change, and you are thinking this is kinda strange. You stumble to leap, but fall to the floor, and then comes a stone cold echo of the slamming door. When you step outside of reality, spook you right out of your skin. Things aren't quite what they seem. It strikes past midnight. Your bones start to rattle and prance like you're stuck in a train. In 1943, chairman of IBM, Thomas Watson, said, "I think there is a world market for maybe 5 computers."
Science.
News just in. An MIT algorithm predicts the future by watching TV.
Dolly the sheep's clone sisters are alive and well.
Analysing bugs in our snot has led to a new antibiotic.
And the latest search for dark matter has come up empty.
Some top news stories right there. Yaz, tell me all about this dark matter.
So yeah, dark matter. I love dark matter, or thinking about it. It's not the same as antimatter, which is the opposite of matter. It is the thing that makes up sort of 20-something% of the weight of galaxies, and we know it's there, but it's unexplained.
It's really hard to detect,
and it's hard to detect, and what is it? And it's given scientists the slip yet again. So in a most recent experiment at the Large Underground Xenon Experiment, or LUX, which I quite like the name of. So they've reported
light,
that they're
looking for dark.
They've collected data from 2014 until now, and it contains no evidence of dark matter, the mysterious substance that makes up more than actually now 25% of the universe. So we've still not found it. It's 25% of the universe, and we can't seem to see it anywhere. Maybe. But this is also a good example of how a failed experiment isn't a bad experiment.
Yeah, this is how science works.
Yay. Because it helps us rule out other possibilities. So it's, now we know it's not this, now we know it's not this. So we've looked at everything. It's not any of those things. Moving on, what's the next thing? That's equally as useful to narrowing down. And eventually, I'm sure we'll get there.
Yeah, and it's always those things tend to be underreported because they're not as exciting. So it's good that it makes the news. So my MIT algorithm, this is really fun. Basically, they created an algorithm, a bit of a computer brain, and it watched 600 hours of clips from The Office, The Big Bang Theory, and other kind of TV shows. And it learned to identify high fives, handshakes, hugs, and kisses, and also what the moments leading up to those interactions looked like. And then it was tested. So it was given a freeze frame of a particular picture, where an interaction was going on, and it had to predict what would happen next. And the algorithm got it right 43% of the time. Now, this doesn't sound very good when you consider that humans get it right 71% of the time. Although, weirdly, like, why don't we get it right more?
Yeah.
But as the researchers pointed out, like, even toddlers have more experience of life than this machine has had. Mm-hmm. So if you had years of watching TV, imagine how good it could be.
Mm. Yeah.
That is quite exciting.
That is exciting.
And always love to hear that there's new antibiotic on the loose. Right, on to our next song. And then we will be talking about what it means to be human in the 21st century and everything you have sent in. So this is your last chance. Tweet us at Science Mixtape whilst listening to Dance or Die by Janelle Monáe. Run on for your life, or you can dash, you can die. She's praying over saying like she's the last samurai. Got to stick up, and pick up. Telling lies, and put your face on fire. Run and take your friends and never dream of a win. Ghettos keep it crying to the street full of zombies. Kids are killing kids, and then the kids on the army. Rising and awaken, yes, I hear come the signs. Marching to the ruin with the kick of the drum. The wisest in me, and they got the bombs and the guns. So you might as well keep dancing if you're not gonna run.
In 1959, the US Postmaster General said, "Before man reaches the moon, your mail will be delivered within hours from New York to Australia by guided missiles. We stand on the threshold of rocket mail."
I love that. I think that's my favourite fact. I wish we had rocket mail today. Well, I guess maybe like emails.
Yeah, I guess he's quite the same. He kind of got it.
So, turning to the big question of the virtual future, what does it mean to be human in the 21st century? Producer Yaz, what ideas have we had?
We've had, a lot of ideas. People can really talk about this. I think that's something important to take away from it, is that people actually think about this a lot. So I don't know what I'd say, but Tara has said that at the moment she's feeling quite outmatched by technology, that it's sort of outpacing us or not controlling us directly, but... you know, the way we live. And Gemma just says it makes her feel slightly vulnerable to have the insecurity in the world that we have at the moment.
And Iman, you were asking your friends as well, what did they say?
Yeah, I mean, it was much the same thing. It was kind of a bit bleak. We had some of my friends were talking about wars, a kind of division and things like that. But one of my friends, Layla, actually said that being in the 21st century means that we're getting better at being human. We're getting better at diplomacy, getting better at technology and science, and all that stuff is bringing us together, which is a really nice, positive outlook, I think.
Yeah. Alex, I think, as we were saying before, we've had quite a few that are more like dichotomies, haven't we? One from a privileged white female aged 59 years. So this wasn't a tweet.
Wishing to remain anonymous. So, yeah, saying that there's just a huge inequality between different individuals alongside the huge advances in technology, which give us so much, like instant communication. And there's this whole world of knowledge that we can all sort of like tap into and access. But there, worry that you're not keeping up.
On being vulnerable and those comments, I think it's the fact that technology is making so much progress, but we don't understand it. I mean, I use technology all the time and have no idea how it works. So maybe that makes us feel like we're being left behind a bit. Yeah. We have these things that could be so much cleverer than us. I have no idea where it begins.
I think, so again, another listener, Robbie, he hits the nail on the head. He said, "We're always connected, but we're increasingly isolated." You know, a smartphone gives anyone who's got it the access to the sum total of human knowledge. And we can connect with almost anyone nearly instantly. But there's been a rise of kind of feelings of isolation and mental health issues. And is one causing the other, essentially? And that's something that I like when I was thinking, what was my answer to this? That's, I think, what I think. What does it mean to be human? For me, what makes us stand apart from other animals is our kind of language and our emotional connections, and also that kind of like ambition and desire in us, the sense that we have to find meaning in our lives. I mean, I don't think a dog needs to find meaning in its life.
I think it has all the meaning it needs.
And so in some ways our technology really helps us do that. Like it helps us connect with people. It helps drive, I think, that ambitious side of us. But I think sometimes with so much possibility, we become overwhelmed. And with so many people we could connect with, do those connections become less meaningful?
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
I totally agree that it's something you just have to be very aware of, and you have to stay kind of, find other things that keep you grounded, and, mm-hmm. and find other, go back to kind of your roots to find non-technological things that keep you human.
Definitely. I agree. I think everyone wants that too.
Just a shout out to my dad, who his answer to this was, you should talk about three parents with a third one supplying the mitochondria. That makes us very different.
I think he's right.
And so we will leave you with that. Thank you so much for all your wonderful ideas, and thank you as well to Yaz and Iman for joining me today as we ride that wave of unpredictability.
Yeah, Luke, who knows what the future will hold.
Yeah, Luke, wherever you are, we hope you enjoy listening to
your podcast.
Thank you for being the inspiration behind it, and yes. If anyone wants to find out more about Luke and what he does, just go to virtualfutures.com. Now his final song is called Prototype by Victoria Modesta, and she is incredible. She has a prosthetic leg but has taken it to great new heights and like made it sort of a fashion item and become a real kind of symbol and icon because of this. And she's just a world famous pop star, so this is her song Prototype. The canny amongst you will have noticed that we forgot to give you the answer to our brain teaser on air. So we're giving it to you now. Yay. Iman didn't know the answer. This was her suggestion.
I thought it was the car.
The car. Well, I can tell you, Iman, you are wrong. And reveal that the answer to our brain teaser. What was the president of the Stevens Institute of Technology describing when he said, everyone acquainted with the subject will recognise it as a conspicuous failure? Is actually the light bulb. He was talking about the light bulb back in the 1880s, and he did not think it was going to be a success.
Well, how wrong he was.
Exactly. Well done, any of you that got it. Goodbye.
Science.